Next, I'm going to read you an article that explores the post-September 11th American zeitgeist. What has changed and what hasn't? The author is Elliot Weinberger, a poet and essayist based in New York City. It's titled, New York, One Year After, September 1st, 2002. On the verge of the first anniversary, and a commemorative media frenzy that may send the country into diabetic shock, one can either retreat to the hills like a Chinese sage, or contemplate, for a moment, from near or far, ground zero. There is nothing there. The rubble has been scraped clean, so that the area now truly resembles its eponym, the ground zero of a nuclear attack. The empty air once occupied by the towers is almost palpable. And yet the utter nothingness of the scene is calming. A refuge of silence, an anti-memorial that is the best possible memorial, a still center around which swirls a world and a year of continual and continually mutating madnesses. Since September 11th, the American national obsession has been the delineation of how we are different. It seems that every magazine or newspaper article, regardless of subject, marital relations, video games, summer vacations, the new fiction, must now include at least one paragraph demonstrating how its subject, or the future of its subject, has been irrevocably transformed by that terrible day. We has always been a useless generalization in a nation inhabited by a plurality of peoples who have almost nothing in common except for their taste in certain consumer goods and fast food, a taste now shared by hundreds of millions in other countries who are supposedly not us. In fact, the word American, when applied to anything other than the policies of the U.S. government, is nearly always meaningless. There are too many exceptions to the rule. Nevertheless, to indulge in this first-person plural, it is difficult to see how the artifacts and attitudes of Americans have changed at all since September 11th. To take an obvious example, more people than ever went to the movies this summer to watch things getting blown up, even in the case of Spider-Man, blown up in New York. Movies that, according to the commentators on September 12th, would never be made again, for reality had overtaken illusion. But somehow, despite disaster and expert readings of the zeitgeist, life and Spider-Man have a way of going on. And yet, something is indeed different. To put it simply, we are the same, but we are nervous wrecks. In the last year, Americans have become like the novitiates in cults, kept awake and in a state of constant distraction. Or more precisely, like the captured spy in the 1960s movies, whose form of torture is to be tied to a chair in a small room with blaring music and images flashing on the walls. Two powerful forces have combined to drive Americans crazy. On one side, the White House team. In this case, one cannot, as usual, personify and refer to an administration by the name of its leader, for George W. Bush has exactly the same relationship to the policies of his government as Britney Spears does to the operations of the Coca-Cola Corporation. Like all despotic governments, and I do not use the word lightly, they have recognized that the best way to solidify popular support is by exaggerating internal and external threats to the society. On the other side, there is the hyperbolic and hysterical 24-hour news media, continually in need of further sensationalism to keep their audience frozen before the television. Together, the two have created a kind of techno-rave of the disturbing and the frightening, with each new artificial panic blending into the next and erasing the memory of the previous one. We've been driven crazy because every 2 or 3 weeks for many months, the FBI or the bizarre Christian fundamentalist Attorney General John Ashcroft would announce that another terrorist attack was imminent and a certainty in the next few days, or this weekend, or next week. so that no American would feel complacent. The targets were spread around the country. The Golden Gate Bridge, the Sears Tower, the Lincoln Memorial, Disney World, the Liberty Bell, and even, God forbid, Universal Studios. Ashcroft, having apparently watched The Manchurian Candidate too many times, periodically warned of sleeper cells of Al-Qaeda terrorists living anonymously, maybe right next door, who could be awakened at any moment. Nearly every day, airports were evacuated, malls emptied, traffic stalled for hours, crawling through checkpoints. We've been driven crazy because, in the first weeks after September 11th, the media endlessly fixated on the possibilities and consequences of terrorist biological weapons attacks, and specifically on anthrax. Predictably, this led to some thrill-seeking loner, a stock character in America, sending anthrax spores through the mail, spreading fear among all those citizens not in immediate proximity to historical monuments and theme parks. Equally predictably, the White House team and the subservient media pronounced this to be the work of Arab terrorists. Though it was obvious from the first day that the poisoned letters were being sent by one of our own Timothy McVeigh or Unabomber types, an international terrorist might release anthrax spores in the Washington Metro, but he wouldn't mail them to a celebrity gossip tabloid popular in the supermarkets of the American provinces. And we now know that the White House team was so obsessed with finding an Iraqi connection that it actually forbade the FBI, which is inept enough without outside help, from pursuing domestic leads. It still takes months for a letter sent to any branch of the government to arrive. For all their mail, like an American dinner, must be cooked in a microwave. We've been driven crazy because the secret arrest and deportation without trial of thousands of men, the exact number is unknown, for the crime of being Middle Eastern or dark-skinned or speaking a foreign language in a public place, a group that included Israeli Jews and Indian Sikhs, was terrifying not only for Muslim Americans, but for millions of legal and illegal residents of non-European origin. Among the Latin Americans I talked with, poor people with a very hazy idea of Muslims, but an encyclopedic knowledge of immigration laws and practices, there was a general belief that it would be first them, then us. We've been driven crazy because the secret arrests, the pronouncements by Ashcroft that any criticism of the government was an act of treason, the internet postings of lists of university professors who criticized the government, the presidential proposal to create an army of millions of government informers composed of postmen, gas and electric meter readers, pizza delivery men, and anyone else who rings a doorbell, and the warnings from that grim reaper, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, whom Henry Kissinger, of all people, once called the scariest person I've ever met, about traitors among us leaking classified information, combined to provoke fears of reprisal among those with opinions to express, whether publicly or privately. After all, the bedrock of American democracy is, in theory, freedom of speech. In practice, this has meant that anyone can say anything because no one is listening. Suddenly, there was the possibility that people like Ashcroft were listening, and that critics would be turned into dissidents, facing tangible repercussions for their intangible ideas. We've been driven crazy by the wars, actual and threatened. It has been forgotten that on September 10th, Bush was an extremely unpopular president. The economic boom of the Clinton years was crashing, and he was generally seen as a fool, the butt of nightly jokes by television comedians, an automaton controlled by his Dr. Mabuse, Dr. No, Dr. Evil Vice President Dick Cheney, a president who hadn't even been elected, but had taken office in a kind of judicial coup d'etat. The only hope for Bush was a war to rally the nation, as his father had done in his own economic crisis. And it is evident that if September 11th hadn't occurred, the U.S. would have invaded Iraq late in the year. The team began talking about it on the first day of the Bush presidency, but they needed to put the administration in place and wait for cooler weather in the desert. September 11th gave them an alternate opportunity. Instead of treating the attack, as was done in Europe, as a monstrous crime whose perpetrators were dead but whose accomplices needed to be apprehended, it was immediately categorized as an act of war, a new Pearl Harbor, which it clearly was not. War, as has often been said, is politics or business by other means. The attempted coercion of the other side to accept one's policies or products or sovereignty. Al-Qaeda, like all revolutionary youth movements, is more concerned with consciousness than political realities. And the Trade Center attack was a kind of grotesque advertisement for itself. In the absence of a tangible enemy with whom to wage war, the team quickly confused Al-Qaeda with the Taliban in the public mind, and launched the so-called War on Terrorism, which was rather like firebombing Sicily to eradicate the mafia heroin trade, proclaimed new and thrilling victories every day, and slaughtered many more innocent people than died on September 11th. As for Osama bin Laden or any other important Al-Qaeda member, the War on Terrorism never did, in Bush's famous John Wayne words, smoke 'em out and hunt 'em down. But no matter. The media were delighted with the capture of a pathetic California teenager, whom they quickly named the Rat, as they clamored for his execution. Until his family hired some expensive lawyers, the American way of justice, and saved his life. But no matter. Ashcroft soon interrupted television programs to announce via satellite from Moscow the sensational arrest of a sinister-looking man with an Arab name who was about to explode radioactive dirty bombs in unnamed American cities. This led to days of televised delirium about how easy it is to make such bombs and their potential death tolls and how we can or cannot protect ourselves. Until it was revealed that the nefarious dirty bomber was a Puerto Rican street gang member from Chicago who had converted to Islam in prison and whose sinister plot had consisted entirely of looking up radioactive bomb on an internet search engine. But no matter. With nothing panic-inducing coming from Afghanistan, the White House team scanned the horizon for other places to imagine waging war. Indonesia, the Philippines, Syria. Plans were proposed, gloated over, and forgotten. Then, having already refused to support the negotiations initiated by Clinton between North and South Korea, the team suddenly out of nowhere and on the basis of nothing began threatening to drop the big one on North Korea. The first time the U.S. government has ever spoken of an offensive first strike with a nuclear weapon. This was followed by Bush's famous Axis of Evil speech. The Axis, as you may have forgotten, consisted of the closely allied nations of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, but somehow omitted the Vandals, the Huns, and the Visigoths, which was so scary that my children seriously asked whether it wasn't a good idea to move to Costa Rica. And now, of course, the team is waging a weird simulacrum of war in Iraq, in the manner of the tactical board games that geeks used to play before the age of Nintendo. Every day they announce different battle strategies, complete with maps, which are followed by explanations, apparently based on telepathy, of what Saddam's defensive strategies will be. But most of all, more than the nightmares of sleepwalking terrorists, secret police, nuclear strikes, and the junk mail of doom, in the last year we've been driven crazy by money. During the Clinton years, for the first time, the middle class put most of their savings, particularly their retirement pension savings, in the stock market. Now they've lost half of it, and in many cases much more than half. And the collapse of the stock market has meant that many millions have either lost their jobs or must work at severely reduced wages. This, more than anything, has been devastating in a country founded on the pursuit of happiness, and the dream of the bright future. Typically, the White House team's solution to this crisis is to cut the taxes of those who earn more than $2 million a year. And they not only want to cut corporate taxes, but also make the cuts retroactive so that the corporations would get back the money they'd paid over the last 12 years. As there is still supposedly an opposition party called the Democrats, they prudently chose a dozen and not 50 or 100 years. Is it possible to understand the United States? Europeans tend to think of it merely as a richer, more vulgar, and more violent version of Europe. But the two have little in common other than large numbers of white people. The United States is a banana republic with a lot of money. It is perhaps the most perfect form of banana republic. Its generals do not have to seize power or even concern themselves with those tedious domestic, non-military matters, for regardless of who the ostensible leader of the government is, the generals always get what they want, lots and lots of toys to play with. Often the Congress even gives them toys they don't want. Moreover, like the generals of a banana republic, they have no great desire, since the Vietnam War, to kill people with those toys, as that might mean that some of their own boys would be killed. They're equipment fetishists, and all they want is the latest hardware and elaborate maneuvers in which to try it out. Their kind of war is Grenada, the only war they've won in the last 50 years, and their reluctance to go to war continues to be the greatest force for peace in the nation. If one considers so-called intelligence as part of defense, approximately 2/3 of the American tax dollar goes to the generals. This naturally leaves very little for anything else, which is why the U.S., in terms of infrastructure and general well-being, is the banana republic of industrialized nations, with 25% of its children living in poverty, the worst education system, the worst mass transit, no socialized medicine, the highest rates of illiteracy and infant mortality and teenage pregnancy, homeless millions, and small cities that look as though they've just been through the plague. Like that of any banana republic, the government is largely controlled by the rich. This has become even more exaggerated since the rise of the dominance of television in American politics. One now needs vast amounts of money to buy television advertisements in order to get elected. A minor position in local government costs $1 million. The last presidential campaign cost $1 billion. And those who manage to get elected must then spend the majority of their time raising the money for their re-elections. That money, needless to say, comes from the people or corporations who have it. And those people or corporations, needless to say, expect things in return. American politics would be completely transformed overnight if television campaign advertisements were banned, as they are in most of the world. But that would entail the system voluntarily deciding to destroy itself. Nevertheless, before the age of Bush, there was always the assumption that a few things had to be done for the good of the people who are actually casting the votes. This was partially because one needed those votes again, and partially because the non-elected government officials tended to come from the ranks of civil servants who, after all, had decided to dedicate their lives to serving the citizens. But banana republics are sometimes ripe and sometimes rotten, and this White House team is something entirely new. Nearly all of them, having worked for Bush Sr., spent the Clinton years in the executive offices of oil, energy, and pharmaceutical corporations. The chief of staff was the primary lobbyist in Washington for the auto industry against pollution controls. And Condoleezza Rice, the team's own Xena the Warrior, even has an oil tanker named after her. In the year 2000 alone, the year before they joined Junior's board of directors, nearly every one of them, including Colin Powell, earned between $20 and $40 million. Most of them have a net worth of at least $100 million, and many have much more. Considering that Bush wasn't even elected, his team represents a corporate hostile takeover of the U.S. government. Let us drill into the skull of George W. Bush. He might not be as stupid as it is widely assumed, but he is a man without curiosity who doesn't read books or newspapers, watch television, go to the movies, or listen to any kind of music. He's much like Osama bin Laden, another formerly dissolute son of a wealthy family, not so coincidentally close friends and business partners with the Bushes, except that Osama presumably reads one book. Before being elected president, Bush had only left the country very briefly, once or twice, a business trip to Saudi Arabia, a beach vacation in Mexico. On his first trip to Paris this year, he declared, "Jacques Chirac tells me that the food is fantastic here, and I'm going to find out." He has spent his entire life in a world as provincial as that of the House of Saud, and evidently one where France is never mentioned. A tiny circle of Texas oil and energy millionaires who repeatedly rescued him from his financial disasters because he was the president's son and a nice guy and one of them. In the manner of patrician families, he believes, as his father did, that he and his team know what's best for the country and the world, and they have no patience for tiresome other opinions. When they had to formulate an energy policy for the administration, they assembled a group of energy corporation executives without bothering to include even a token environmentalist or consumer advocate or labor leader, and then they refused to release the proceedings. When they recently organized a conference to discuss the economic crisis, only large contributors to the Republican Party and small-town Republican businessmen were invited. The team believes in secret government, which has been epitomized by the bizarre disappearance of Vice President Cheney Mabuse, supposedly to protect him from terrorists, though the team's spokesperson Bush makes frequent public appearances, which would always lead to speculation that he was dead until he, or perhaps a double, miraculously turned up again on television. This is why they couldn't care less if the rest of the world, even their own generals, is opposed to an invasion of Iraq. They know that men must do what they have to do, and some of them, Bush himself included, truly believe that God has chosen them, though of course it is a different God from the one who has chosen bin Laden. If you drill into Bush's skull, what you mainly find is a pool of oil. It's difficult to understand Bush, especially when he speaks, but it is somewhat easier if one realizes he sees the whole world exclusively in terms of the production and consumption of oil. Long before September 11th, he was discussing the overthrow of the Taliban so that Unocal could build a pipeline through Afghanistan from Kazakhstan to Pakistan. The current U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan, the equivalent of ambassador, was Unocal's chief consultant on the project. The only country in the Western Hemisphere that has attracted his attention is Venezuela, where he tried to overthrow Hugo Chavez, because that's where the oil is. He has no interest in Palestine and Israel because they have no oil. Libya is notably not a member of the Axis of Evil because Gaddafi has made arrangements with the oil companies. Europe is a petty annoyance that doesn't even have any oil. Russia has oil, and Bush has said that when he looked deep into Putin's eyes, he knew he was a good man. The totalitarian terrorist-supporting nation of Saudi Arabia is our friend because the oil flows. The totalitarian terrorist-supporting nation of Iraq is our enemy because the oil can't flow. But if you drill to the core of George W. Bush's being, there is something else, something that seems so hyperbolic, that so smacks of the clichés of old communist propaganda that it is hardly believable. And yet, the evidence of his term as governor of Texas and the daily evidence of his presidency proves that it is true. Once one clears away the rhetoric that he has handed to read out loud, it is apparent that Bush believes that his role, his only role, as President of the United States, is to help his closest friends. When he was governor, he took over countless public funds and operations, eliminated the public oversight committees, and simply handed the money or the work to his golf buddies. Houston, almost overnight, became the most polluted city in the U.S. because he introduced voluntary compliance with environmental laws, and, needless to say, no one complied. Now that he is president, his team has completely restaffed the middle level of the bureaucracy, the place where the day-to-day intangible laws are affected, and they in turn have changed innumerable rules and regulations, not to the benefit of big business in general, as might be expected, but as specific gifts to the oil, energy, mining, logging, and pharmaceutical corporations run by the Bush crowd. Every day, in the back pages of the newspaper, there is yet another story that strains credulity. I'll mention only two. No doubt at the urging of Rumsfeld, a former pharmaceutical CEO, the team eliminated the law that required drug companies to perform separate tests on medicine that is prescribed for children. Why should they spend the money? And only a few days after it came out in the press that there were massive Enron-style accounting irregularities in the Halliburton Corporation when Cheney was its CEO, the White House announced that the $100 million project to expand the prison at Guantanamo Bay in expectation of more Afghan peasants to be held forever without trial was awarded to the Halliburton Corporation. One must go back to the 19th century to find this level of oblivious corruption in the White House. After September 11th, many intellectuals abroad and many others privately or publicly celebrated the attack, after some perfunctory hand-wringing about loss of life, as a humiliating blow against the American empire and a just reward for the decades of American hegemony and aggression. 1 year after, it is worth remembering the concrete facts of the consequences of that day. Because the attack happened early in the morning, the nearly 3,000 people who died were generally of three types. First, poor people, most of them black, Hispanic, or recent immigrants, who worked as janitors, handymen, food deliverers, and so on, in the towers and the adjoining buildings. Second, low-ranking white-collar workers, the secretaries and clerks who had to be in the office before the bosses arrived. And third, firemen, policemen, and other rescue workers. Very few titans of capitalism or people in power died that day. The devastation of the downtown business area and the subsequent collapse of the tourist industry caused at least 100,000 people, most of them poor, to lose their jobs. The secret arrests and deportations ruined the lives of some thousands of Muslim men and their families, not a single one of whom had any connection to the hijackings, and brought continuing fear to hundreds of thousands of others. Immigration to the U.S. has essentially ground to a halt, with the consequent hardships to countless divided families and the millions in third world countries who depend on the money earned by relatives in the U.S. Among many other specific cases, 100,000 Mexican and Canadian students who commuted to colleges and universities across the border can no longer attend classes. For the Mexicans especially, this education was their hope for decent employment. Thousands of innocent people in Afghanistan are dead, and tens of thousands displaced. The potential deaths in Iraq or elsewhere remain to be seen. George W. Bush, a fool on September 10th, became a powerful and popular leader. He and his team are the most globally frightening White House in modern times, far more frightening than Nixon or Reagan, and they can now do anything they want. Hardly a blow against the empire, the Trade Center attack created one of the most arrogant and aggressive administrations in American history, one that has already demonstrated its impatience with, or repugnant for, such foundations of American democracy as free speech, open elections, due process of law, and the separation of church and state. And their actions will have incalculable ramifications, large and small, throughout the world, from the acceleration of global warming to the end of birth control programs in third world villages. For the White House team, the hijacked planes were a blessing from the sky. A few days ago, a man listed as one of the September 11th dead was discovered in a psychiatric hospital, a total amnesiac who has no idea what happened to him or what has happened since. On the same day, George W. Bush told an interviewer what the saddest thing has been about his presidency. He now only has time to jog 3 miles a day. And I was reading from New York, 1 year after, written by Elliot Weinberger.
I saw the plane hit the building, the flames and the billowing smoke. I saw the glass, metal, paper, and stone. Everything shattered and broke. I was there with my people, Engine Company 24. We marched into the building, got as far as the 35th floor. The black smoke and the heat was like nothing I'd seen in all of my years. With each step in that burning inferno, you could feel destiny near. Amidst all of the falling girders, the sheetrock and God knows what else, I tried to find the survivors, those who made it to the stairwells. I carried the wounded to safety, if that's what you might call the street. With bodies and boulders and metal all crashing down at your feet. As number two was collapsing, when only 10 floors still stood, everything was falling around me like it was made out of cardboard and wood. That's when I heard someone trapped underneath the debris. I started pulling at something, and that's when the fire got me. I was pinned beneath the rubble. The flames were licking my coat. The pain, the unbearable agony. And then that was all that she wrote. I just wish I could tell you before I am taken away that I've seen a lot of this world, and there's something that I gotta say. I don't believe in politics. I believe in the human race. I believe in the goodness of people in New York or some faraway place. I believe in my daughter, and I believe in my wife, and may nobody's father be taken to avenge the loss of my life. Some people may call me a brave man, and this may very well be, but the firefighters of Kabul are just as brave men as me.
What we've seen is that on the one hand, September 11th has changed things dramatically, but also it's marked a continuation of policies, that we have a situation in which the rulers of this country, who are a tiny class of people, have seized upon the tragedy of September 11th, 2001, to continue policies and intensify policies that they wanted to institute anyway before September 11th.
Chris Mann, Chicago-based historian and activist, speaking with Mike Thornton of People's Tribune Radio.
And in the guise of fighting terrorism, what they have done is seriously eroded civil liberties in this country and moved towards the establishment of a police state. All this is happening at the same time that we see, for the majority of people in this country, growing insecurity. I mean, if we talk about terrorism, what is more terrifying than the prospect of losing your job, than the prospect of being homeless, than the prospect of seeing your own children go to bed hungry? And we have a situation in this country today in which one out of every five children in America goes to bed hungry. One of the ironies of the year since September 11th, 2001 has been that we saw people in New York City on September 11th, 2001 rushing down the stairs of the World Trade Center and then streaming out of Midtown Manhattan. And people who made it out of those buildings embraced their loved ones and were trembling. And since then, what we've seen is at other very large skyscrapers, people rushing downstairs, people in those cases having been ordered out. Here in Chicago, I was really struck one evening watching the evening news, seeing people coming down the stairs of Arthur Anderson with their cardboard box of the contents of their desk after Arthur Anderson collapsed, certainly in a different way than the World Trade Center collapsed, but it definitely collapsed. And people there were embracing their spouses who'd come to pick them up. There was a employee, a 22-year veteran of the Enron Corporation, who made what I thought was a very, very telling comment. She said, "I feel like I've been a victim of economic terrorism." That's really the question before us over this year of how do we define the word terrorism when we have thousands of people who've lost their jobs at these major corporations. Aren't they, in fact, the victims of terrorism, of potential violence, when we know that the suicide rate increases after these kinds of layoffs, when we know that abuse increases? And how are we to respond to this situation where a very small handful of people are I think, seizing upon the events of September 11th to pursue a political agenda which they had in mind beforehand anyway?
Mann is not the only person who's accused the ruling class of seizing upon the tragedy of 9/11 to forward its own agenda. But what does he mean by that?
You have a situation in which something happened that allowed a ruling class to do certain things which it wanted to do and, in fact, had actually planned to do before the events of September 11th. I mean, clearly, the rulers of this country wanted to do certain things in Central Asia, in the Afghanistan area, before the events of September 11th. Clearly, they wanted to change civil liberties in this country, erode civil liberties. I mean, you look at all the appointments, for instance, to the Supreme Court, to the federal judiciary at the levels below the Supreme Court, the selection of Ashcroft himself as Attorney General, and all sorts of decisions. They clearly wanted to erode civil liberties in this country before September 11th, but the events of September 11th gave them an excuse and allowed them to, with certain sections of the population, get acceptance for those moves, whereas perhaps there might not have been as much acceptance before September 11th. So it's in that sense that I mean seize the opportunity.
Very often it's said that everything changed on 9/11, but did it really?
There are historical precedents for these kinds of attacks on civil liberties in the history of the United States. And in fact, in one sense, it's fairly common. But in another sense, it's completely new. The response to September 11th fits into a pattern of behavior on the part of the powers that be in the United States, the elite, economic and political elite of the United States, going back almost to the beginning of the country. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790s, which were a response to the French Revolution and also just the growing discontent within the United States and the need of the wealthiest merchant capitalists and other forces that were politically dominant in the United States right after the Revolution. You see, that was a major attack on civil liberties, was a major attack on immigrants and on freedom of speech. You then see this running throughout the history of the United States, the laws against agitation against slavery, for instance, the attacks on abolitionist public speakers and newspaper editors. In the 1880s, if we look at the notorious Haymarket affair, where in response to a bomb being thrown at a labor rally, there was an attack on civil liberties, major attack on civil liberties in the United States, an attack on freedom of assembly for immigrants, for trade unionists, for advocates of socialism, anarchism, and other left-wing ideologies. Then at the time of the First World War, the passage of the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act and the attacks on anti-war agitation that at that time. We can continue on and look at the Second World War, the internment of Japanese Americans, and at the McCarthy period. I mean, certainly there are many, many precedents of attacks on civil liberties at various times in the history of the United States in response to things like the throwing of the bomb at Haymarket or the explosion of the battleship Maine, for instance, and the hysteria that followed that. But I think that the thing that's new about this period of time that's really important to note is that for the first time we have a virtually entirely globalized world. For the first time, we have instantaneous communication throughout the world. We have a world in which 447 billionaires have an amount of wealth equal to about 45% of the world's population. We also have a situation in which increasingly things can be produced without human labor by robots and computers, the development of workerless factories. So in this kind of world, this kind of clampdown, I think, represents something different than it did before. The kinds of attacks on freedom of information, on freedom of assembly, the denial of people of the right to lawyers, all of these set precedents, not just to stifle a trade union movement for instance, the 1880s in response to Haymarket, where most people are employed in some kind of manual or mechanical labor and they need a union to get better wages. Today, what we're seeing is a situation in which the attack, the clampdown, is designed, I think, ultimately to contain a new class of people that's completely outside the production process and which is beginning to instinctively put forward demands that threaten the very existence of the system itself.
You're listening to People's Tribune Radio. Today our guest is Chris Mahan, activist, writer, and historian. It's 1 year later, and we're talking about the events of 9/11 and the post-9/11 world. Chris, you just said that much of what's happening post-9/11 has to do with the ruling elite attempting to protect itself against a threat that they perceive as attacking and threatening the very system itself. What do you mean by that?
When you have a situation in which, for instance, in Detroit, cars can be produced, automobiles can be produced by robots rather than by human labor, that's something so new, so qualitatively different, that what it does is that it upsets the entire apple cart in the sense of the entire system of capitalism is built on the idea that there's a capitalist who buys the labor power of a worker. That worker goes to work in the factory and takes orders from the capitalist. He or she gets paid a wage. They then go and they pay their rent. At the beginning of the month, they buy groceries, they give out that money to other capitalists, and it all proceeds in a circle, which leads perhaps to the worker getting nowhere fast in the sense of not being able to advance terribly, but still being able to survive. And the capitalists also being able to get rich. But once you have a situation in which you have what we have now, where you can have workerless production, that upsets everything to the point that the auto worker who gets laid off, he or she is not able to then pay their rent, buy those groceries. They end up homeless. They end up in a situation where they have to put forward demands like, give me a house that I can't pay for, that threatens the very existence of the system itself. You know, let me live, let me survive. And so you have this situation on an international level where there are now millions of people in the world who are outside of this capitalist economy. Their very existence and their very day-to-day demands are demands that the system cease to exist and that society be reorganized where there's distribution according to need. I mean, that's what they're groping towards, what they're pushing for from below. And that really does threaten the system in a way that someone who's employed, who's demanding better wages, doesn't threaten the system. And so because of that, you have a situation where this tiny handful of millionaires and billionaires that controls the world economy has to end civil liberties. I mean, it has to stop this mass of poor people from expressing its demands, from congregating. I mean, that's why there's tax on civil liberty, freedom of speech, why there's anti-loitering laws, why there's increased police brutality, why there are all these different things to contain and stop this mass of poor people that's developing. If we look at the global picture, what we see is a situation where, as I said, you have 447 billionaires who control the world economy. You have this incredible mass of poor people. I mean, outside the United States, it's even more apparent and it's even more extreme than inside the United States, where, I mean, there's certainly a lot of poor people here, but the collapse of any kind of middle class is more extreme in other countries than it is here.
In the wake of 9/11, one of the big questions being asked was, why do they hate us? President Bush and his administration, along with the ruling class in the United States, said that the reason that the Islamic world hates us is because they're jealous of our freedoms. There has been a rise in Islamic fundamentalism. Mayen believes that this rise is caused by the globalization of the world economy.
Some parts of the world, I mean, people are groping for any kind of ideology, any kind of means to express themselves, to express their anger. And in certain parts of the world, people are swept up in various kinds of religious fundamentalism. And that's true in Europe, in the Middle East, and in other parts of the world as well. Now, the other thing that you have going on is that certainly the CIA, for instance, has funded all sorts of political and military groupings when it was to their advantage to do so. I mean, particularly in Afghanistan, where the United States authorities spent millions upon millions of dollars to support anybody that was opposed to the government of Afghanistan that was allied with the Soviet Union in order to undermine the Soviet Union. So you have people like Osama bin Laden got their start, basically, being trained by the CIA. We have a world that's in chaos right now. It's completely different than it was 50 years ago, and it's an absolute chaos. And there's an extraordinary amount of violence in the world, and people are groping to figure out, what on earth happened? I mean, we've seen, you look at the changes in the world in the last 50 years. I mean, the end of the direct colonial system, the destruction of the British Empire. The sun was supposed to never set on the British Empire, and now it's burnt it up. The French Empire is no more. The world socialist system is no more. Everything that was built up on the basis of the industrial system or industrial method of production has ceased to exist virtually. And so we have this new world with new means of production, with a tiny handful of millionaires and billionaires running it, and many, many people in poverty, and various ideological forces stepping forward to give explanations, some of which are bad. And some of those ideological forces are winning adherents. But I think the real question before every person of goodwill in the world is, how do we unite the great mass of people who aren't in that 1% of the population that's the 447 billionaires? Because really, in spite of all of what we're being told about how the Muslim is our enemy, or the Arab American is our enemy, or everybody's out to get us and to terrorize us, that the interests of the majority of people in the United States are the same as the interests of the majority of people on this planet, which is to create a world in which we can use these new means of production. I mean, we have the ability today to create homes overnight, to grow food virtually overnight, and yet we have a world with massive starvation and massive homelessness. How do we find a way to wrest the world away from this tiny handful of millionaires and billionaires and build a world in which everyone can have a decent life? I mean, I think that's really the challenge of the post-September 11th world.
Whenever anyone begins to talk about the rights of poor and working people, it seems very often they're met with the accusation that they're promoting class warfare.
In the way that the conservatives use that term, they sort of throw it out as if someone is trying to create class warfare where it doesn't exist. You know, there's some mean people on the left who are like trying to stir up a class warfare when in fact there are no classes in the United States. There is class warfare in the United States right now. It's very one-sided, because what it is really is the war being waged by the ruling class on this new class of poor people. It's a very one-sided war, because I think that the ruling class in its heart of hearts knows that it's a class. But right now the reality is that the average person in this new class doesn't know that they're in a separate class. I mean, they don't really think of themselves as being a separate class from the millionaires and billionaires. We've all been told over and over again that there are no classes in America, or that everybody's in the middle class in America, that everybody can make it, that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can become a millionaire or billionaire. And so it's wrong to talk about classes in America. So I think that it's a very one-sided war. It's a situation where people in one army don't know that there's a war going on, and the other army is very well organized and has its operational plans and its officers and its battle strategy, and it's attacking away, and the group that it's attacking doesn't have any West Point yet, doesn't have any officers, doesn't have any basic training, isn't united, and so it's a very, very one-sided war. But I think the first step to remedying that situation is a situation where, if concerned people, conscientious people, conscious people can get out among the millions of people who are in this new class and get across one basic point, which is you are in a different class than the millionaires and billionaires. You have different interests, and it's a perfectly legitimate thing for you to fight for the interests of your class. And the interests of your class are not in contradiction to the interests of the overwhelming majority of humanity. One of the things that the conservatives who sneeringly use the term class warfare do is they sort of imply that someone fighting for the interests of their class is doing something very, very shabby and selfish and sort of narrow-minded. And I think that's completely wrong, that by fighting for the interests of the new class of poor people, anyone who does that, anyone who fights to raise that class to the level of ruling class, is in fact fighting to save the human race, fighting to save the very best in the history of humanity and the culture of humanity, and really to preserve the human race. Because this class of millionaires and billionaires, what they're going to do ultimately, if they are allowed to proceed unchecked, is that they are going to destroy this planet. I mean, they're going to pollute the planet. They're going to turn the entire planet into one gigantic police state. They're going to plunge this planet into war. And by fighting to take political power away from them and put the new class of poor people in the driver's seat of human history. We are fighting to save the human race itself. So we shouldn't be at all ashamed about saying that we are for class warfare, and we want our side to win.
So in looking back at 9/11, what is it that we should learn from this incident about America and its people?
I think the question is, what is America? Is it controlled by a tiny handful of people and being the most powerful country in the world? Or is it that decent side of America that you see on September 11th with everybody, you know, with thousands upon thousands of people donating blood? I mean, immediately nobody having to really ask them, but just people finding their way to a place where they could donate blood, and people going into the World Trade Center and trying to save other people, and the side of America that also said, you know, let's not scapegoat anybody because of September 11th, that formed the human chains in front of the mosque to prevent any kind of hate crimes taking place. Is that America, or is it, you know, Ken Lay and this tiny handful of people who are determined to, this tiny class of people who are determined to rule the world? And I think that what happens sometimes is we get the two mixed up. You know, when we talk about America, we stand united, what does that mean? In a country in which one out of every five children goes to bed hungry. I mean, my response to the slogan, America, we stand united, is, unite food with the mouth of every hungry child in America. And that's the kind of unity that I want to see. And until we have that unity, the unity of every hungry child with some supper, it's not right to talk about unity. It's an empty phrase to talk about unity. So is this country the Statue of Liberty and what it symbolizes? Or is it George Bush and his friends and Arthur Anderson and that class of people? And I think that we're getting to the point where we have to make a choice in this country. And that I think that the interests of the overwhelming majority of people, I mean, most people in this country want to live in a decent world. They want to help other people. And I think that they want to believe that their country is a force for good in the world.
Writer, speaker, activist, and historian Chris Mahan on the one-year anniversary of 9/11. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the tools of robotics and computerization that are currently being used to displace millions of workers around the world are used for the benefit of humanity as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or our other print and audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or on the internet, www.lrna.org.
Your help is urgently needed to stop a life-threatening deportation. The Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, is intervening to try to prevent the impending deportation of Nesereddin Ali Ebrahim back to his native country of Ethiopia. Part of an ethnic and religious minority, Ali was imprisoned and hideously ill-treated by the authorities in that country, but managed to escape. He came to the U.S. in the early 1990s and settled in Florida. After establishing himself, Ali was the very model of how the system demands immigrants conduct themselves. He was continuously employed, never sought public assistance, and had no run-ins with the law of any kind. These factors, coupled with his record of life-threatening persecution, made his application for permanent residency a strong one. He did, however, run into one unexpected problem in that he hired an immigration lawyer who was massively incompetent. Papers were never filed, appeal opportunities ignored, and legal deadlines were allowed to come and go. The lawyer, in fact, is facing disciplinary measures. But, for an immigration matter, improper legal representation counts for nothing, and all legal routes are now exhausted. Ali has spent 2 years in a New Jersey detention facility and faces deportation, torture, and death at the hands of a regime that considers him its enemy. OCAP has been asked to assist in Ali's case and are working to get him accepted into Canada. Canada allows for a special sponsorship where five Canadians can jointly guarantee support for a potential immigrant, and people have been found who are willing and able to play this role. Sadly, however, Ali only found out about OCAP at the last minute. His deportation is set for next Wednesday, the 11th of September. Unless the INS can be pressured into staying his deportation so as to give the Canadian application the weeks it needs to be completed, Ali is in a hopeless situation. OCAP is asking all friends in the United States to try to help locate an elected U.S. politician who would be prepared to intervene in this matter. OCAP, a Canadian organization, has very little ability to put pressure on the INS in Washington. A call from the office of a political figure of some standing would be taken more seriously. If it helped to tip the balance and save Ali's life, it would be worth the effort. You can also contact James Ziegler, the INS Commissioner in Washington, D.C., directly. Please report to OCAP all initiatives you've taken in this matter and any and all responses you get from U.S. officialdom. Sue Collis is the OCAP organizer working on this case. She can be reached at area code 416-925-6939 or by email at OCAP@tao.ca. OCAP@tao.ca. The music used in this edition of Unwelcome Guests was composed and performed by David Rovix. You can download his songs on the web at www.davidrovix.com. That's R-O-V-I-C-S, davidrovix.com.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. The rich will come down like a